A quick note. Today's monologue was recorded a few days before the horrific pogrom that took place in Amsterdam on November 7th, where Jews were beaten, humiliated, made to show their passports to prove their identities, in a coordinated attack only 2 days before the anniversary of Kristallnacht. Only this time, there's a difference. We have Israel. What difference can you make this time around?
There's a speech I've been thinking about a lot over the past year, some key lines of which I will quote for you now. It would not have been possible for us to take power or to use it in the ways we have without social media. We live in the age of the masses. The masses rightly demand that they participate in the great events of the day. Social media is the most influential and important intermediary between a movement and the nation, between the idea and the people. Okay, full disclosure, that's not the exact quote. I took the liberty of inserting the words social media in place of the original word radio. But the meanings are identical, even 91 years after this was originally delivered on August 18, 1933, at the 10th International Radio Exhibition in Berlin. The author of these words is none other than Joseph Goebbels, the infamous architect of the Nazi propaganda machine, who paved the path for Jewish genocide straight through the minds of the everyday masses. His speech was entitled Radio as the Eighth Great Power, a riff on Napoleon's assertion of press as the seventh great power behind the six great nations of his day. Bonus points if you can name all six without Google, we'll put them in the show notes. Taking up this mantle, it would surely be appropriate to anoint social media as today's next great power. And one can imagine a Sinwar or Nasrallah saying that without social media, it would not have been possible for us to take power or to use it in the ways we have. The unending tsunami of anti-Israel, anti-Jew propaganda and vitriol online can feel absolutely overwhelming. As my recent guest Van Jones put it, it's like we left an undefended basket open and Hamas, Iran, Russia, China, they're just draining threes and running up the scoreboard while we try to figure out what game we're even playing. Our enemies excel at this brand of subversive social disruption, measurably influencing American minds, turning us against our values and each other to their benefit. And despite knowing this manipulation is happening, I'm talking hard evidence of expensive and elaborate campaigns to poison our society, we keep losing the forest for the trees. I mean, TikTok is literally owned and run by China, an authoritarian surveillance state, and we know this, and still millions of Americans seem to have a recurring case of temporary forgettiness and continue to absorb the algorithm uncritically at face value. It's clear we have to do something. Over the past year, I've been in contact with dozens of different Jewish organizations and initiatives, all trying to throw spaghetti at the wall of the social media problem to see what sticks. We need bot farms, we need influencers, we need celebrities, we need commercials. But when you're losing 8 gajillion to 0, the strategy of, okay, let's start copying what they're doing as fast as we can, doesn't exactly scream coup de grace, as Napoleon himself might say. We need a different approach, a comprehensive tactic that goes beyond just messaging if we want to undo the brainwashing that has already been so effectively done. To figure out this future, let us look to the past. When we learn about the terrifying experience of the days under Hitler and the Third Reich, we can't help but wonder, what would I have done? Would I have spoken out, joined the resistance, seen the writing on the wall? Would I be the neighbor hiding Jews in my attic or turning them in for reward? Would I have fled or fought or prayed and waited? In my experience, we always overestimate ourselves in regards to this question. We like to believe we would have been one of the righteous ones or the brave ones. But if every man and woman had been righteous and brave in 1933, there would have been no Holocaust. So we know that's not the case. And while we will never be able to answer the question of what we might have done then, we can answer it now, in 2024, in the historical moment of our lifetimes in which we find ourselves today. Remember, the beginning of a disaster is never the beginning of the story. The Hitler Youth, the slow Nazi indoctrination of an entire generation, began in 1922, 16 years before even Kristallnacht. What if every Jew and ally had spoken up then? Could they have changed the outcome? Which leads me to this, dear listeners, a call to action. Jews may stink at messaging and optics, but boy, are we good at making shit happen in the real world. I mean, the average person has no idea that Jews are responsible for their Waze app or favorite Christmas song or for winning an inordinate amount of Nobel Prizes, but that hasn't stopped us from winning them, you know? When it comes to the social media battle for moral clarity, no amount of memes or reels or infographics alone is going to change our fate. And yet, we all know how easy it is to get lost in the vortex, the mind-numbing rabbit holes, the endless doom-scrolling. And so I want to gift you a little nugget, a simple yet profound maxim to set your watch by from this moment forward. It's one I heard from Rabbi Susan Goldberg, leader of Nefesh, a spiritual outreach community based on LA's East Side. She said, "For every minute you spend scrolling, spend a minute doing." I wrote it down immediately. So straightforward and yet potentially so impactful. And importantly, so achievable. Doing can mean so many things. Start a Jewish club at your school. Host a group watch of the Nova documentary, We Will Dance Again. Bring dreidels and gelt into your workplace for Hanukkah. Call a city council member to combat a BDS proposal. Check in on a Jewish friend. Buy Israeli products. Throw a fundraiser. Attend a fundraiser. On and on and on. Don't let the scope of the work required or your current bandwidth for doing it stand in your way. You don't need to run a nonprofit or quit your job or start a podcast to make a difference. Just do something. It all makes a difference. We are where we are today because of acquiescence and inaction. But when we normalize standing up and taking space for ourselves, guess what happens? It becomes normal. And if Jews owning our awesomeness ever becomes normal, it's going to be a whole lot harder to push us around. So, what would you have done during Goebbels' time? Well, when you're done scrolling, see what you decide to do today, and you'll have your answer. This is the 9th episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt. New York City, center of the universe, home to world-famous pizzas, deli, dim sum, all kinds of yummy foods we crave. And my guest today knows a thing or two about yummy food. She's a prolific writer, culinary expert, and a fixture on television's most popular food show of the 21st century. She's also a mother, a Canadian, a bringer of briskets, and a noted pickle enthusiast. To know her is to love her. Please welcome Gail Simmons.
One of the best intros ever, I think.
Yes.
That was really, really nice.
Thank you. You know, we try to shine.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Gail and I just had lunch, which is like, you know, playing pickup basketball with Steph Curry, whose nickname, by the way, is Chef Curry. So that was on purpose.
There you go. Yes, I know it.
What's the difference between a chef and a cook, would you say? And which one are you?
I'm a cook. Sometimes I call myself a professional cook, a pro cook. I'm not a chef. To me, the word chef, I'm literal about this. And
yes,
I sort of take it seriously. It was my training. It was the way I was kind of raised in the industry. The word chef is the French word for boss. So when I use the word chef, I mean it about someone who runs a kitchen, who is the
right
boss of a kitchen. I am the chef in my household.
Yeah.
But I do not profess to be a professional chef.
So if I made the assumption that your first most formative memories of being Jewish were based on food,
yes,
would I be correct?
Fair.
Okay.
Absolutely.
What are some of those early keystone memories around Jewish food in your house?
There's a lot. You know, my Jewish background is Ashkenazi. My family, I was born and raised in Toronto. My mother's parents were from Russia and Poland. They moved to Canada, you know, via the St. Lawrence River, which is sort of the Ellis Island of Canada, between the First and Second World Wars, as so many Ashkenazi Jews did.
Is that when there was a big influx into Canada specifically?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. And specifically into Montreal. Mm. My grandmother was an amazing cook, and my mother, in turn, was an extraordinary cook and actually made her living at it for a long time as well. So my first Jewish food memories are brisket, chicken soup, borscht. A lot of beet borscht that my mother, my grandmother made. Kreplach and cabbage rolls. You know, my grandmother was Russian. So right. There was
all
definitely
the classics.
All of that stuff in my household. My father's side was not known for their culinary prowess, I should say. But my father was a pickle maker.
So, by trade?
Like, well, no.
Or just by
I wish.
Hobby.
How cool would that have been? Yeah, yeah. By hobby. He was a chemical engineer.
And
that's he was
similar.
Not a cook. Yes. Well, there's science to it,
yeah.
Right? Fermentation.
Yeah.
My father was not a cook. He smartly acquiesced to my mother. She was the boss in the kitchen. She was the chef.
There you go.
But my father did food projects. So he made wine.
Oh.
He made applesauce, which was also a staple in our house, which I associate with Jewish foods because that is what we ate with our latkes,
mm-hmm.
and with everything else, but specifically with latkes at Hanukkah. And my mother made the best latkes. And I still say that her method is the best method.
Okay, we're going to have to ask
yeah,
you about
we can
that
talk
later.
About that.
Yeah.
But also pickles. My father made full sour kosher dill pickles in mason jars in my basement and kept them in his wine cellar that we would eat all year long. I mean, we ate them after school as snacks, but they were on every Friday night Shabbat table, on every Passover Seder table, at every Hanukkah party. Like, I will forever associate his pickles with my Jewish upbringing. When I got married here in New York City 16 years ago. And I wanted my father to make pickles as a gift to give to all the guests at our wedding. But it proved difficult to cross a border with that many jars of liquid. So him making the pickles and bringing them from Canada was out of the question. So instead, I got a Lower East Side pickle maker to make me, you know, 150 jars of full kosher sourdough pickles. And we labeled them. And the label, not as good as my dad's, but pretty darn close.
Aw, that's so sweet.
Yeah.
I love that.
Pickle juice runs in our blood.
Amazing. So you mentioned your mother, you know, her profession was food.
Yes.
I know she was a food columnist and taught cooking classes
exactly.
in your home.
Mm-hmm.
Did you always know you were going to follow in her footsteps into that industry? Or just you came to it the long way around?
Not even a little. I guess wow. I came to it the long way, but I don't think that I could have come to it any other way. I was very conscious of the fact that my mother was a great cook, never a fancy cook. She was a sophisticated cook in that she was sort of like cooking from scratch. She was going to markets, going to Chinatown to get ingredients. She was a trailblazer in that way. You know, she believed in like sourcing when everyone else was pulling out their microwaves, like in
right.
the 80s, right? For me, it wasn't about fancy food. It was frustrating because all I wanted to eat was the stuff that all my friends were getting to eat at their houses for lunch and dinner. And I wasn't invited because their friends' parents would say that they were like intimidated because they assumed I was used to fancy food. So that was sort of the beginning of a bit of sort of resentment, I
yeah,
guess.
Yeah, I get a little rebellion against
yeah.
that. If somebody watching you in your formative years take your mom aside, would
yeah.
they have been like, oh, she's definitely going to end up working in food? Like, were you in the kitchen all the time? Were you always cooking?
Not really till college. I wanted to write for my student paper.
Mm-hmm.
I loved writing. I knew I loved writing. And I realized—
What kind of writing?
Well, restaurant reviews. I didn't
know— That's what you loved doing? Or I mean, I know that's what
I
you ended up
to. Do.
So you knew I want to do restaurant reviews.
Yes, it seemed cool.
Huh.
And there was no one doing it. So I convinced our student paper editor to let me do it. And they let me do it. Provided I would also do other kinds of reviews. So I was writing some theater reviews. I had no authority to be writing reviews about anything. And the food in Montreal is amazing. So there was plenty to choose from. And that was the first moment that I realized that could be a thing. And started reading food magazines in earnest and cooking in earnest and thinking about food in a bigger way. And it was only then that it dawned on me that that could maybe be a job, which is amazing because I had this role model the whole time
right.
who had been doing it as a job.
In some ways, it's actually sort of similar to my journey in that, you know, like my mom right now is the chairwoman of Jewish Federations in North America. And if you had asked me even like 2 years ago, am I going to be like hosting a Jewish podcast
right.
called Being Jewish?
Yes.
I would have said no way, but here we are.
Here we are. And you know? Thank goodness.
And thank goodness.
Yeah.
Thanks. What was the Jewish community around you growing up in Toronto like?
I grew up in a really warm, welcoming, conservative, very sort of traditional Jewish community. I didn't go to Jewish day school, but we belonged to a synagogue that my family was very invested in and very active in. I went to Hebrew school there 3 days a week. 3 days a week. I mean, if I could get my daughter to just focus for 2 hours, right, a week, I'd be so happy. But it wasn't. It was a non-negotiable.
Mm.
I sang in the shul choir.
Ah.
I did all the shul's plays.
Wait, hold on. What kind of shul plays? Give
lots.
Me a shul play.
I did a lot of musicals, actually, growing up.
I don't know that I've ever heard the phrase shul musical.
Like, I know. There was a musical program. There was like a musical theater program.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So we know what it was like growing up. What's the Jewish community vibe there now in this post-October 7th world?
Yes. Yeah. It has changed for sure. I mean, I think that I grew up in an enormous amount of safety in a community that was broad and inclusive. And I still feel that way. But, you know, there has been an extraordinary outlash of anti-Semitism across Canada, across the world. And you definitely feel it in Canada. A lot of my friends who I grew up with, who I'm still very much in touch with, have children in Jewish day schools there who have been profoundly affected by acts of anti-Semitism in their children's schools. And I think in general, there is just a lot of fear.
Yeah.
And a lot of sadness and grief around the way that our community has always been, you know, we've always thought of ourselves as connected to the bigger community of Toronto and Canada. And it's a really strong community, and it still is. But I definitely feel there's been an enormous amount of loss there, although they've also been incredibly active and dedicated to keeping that community alive and well.
On my list of where people are watching this show from, Canada's number two.
After a number of my friends, I was away with some girlfriends last week, and I told them that I was coming home to be on your podcast. They were very excited.
Oh, I love that.
That's true.
While we were at lunch, you said something I thought was really interesting, that in terms of the makeup of Canada, mm-hmm. it's more a mosaic than a melting pot.
Yes.
I thought that was really fascinating. What do you mean by that?
You know, it's a saying that we as Canadians say often, but really until I lived in the States, I didn't understand it fully. And it's sort of a non-scientific hypothesis about the diversity of Canada. Canada is an incredibly diverse place. It's an extraordinary place made up largely of immigrants because it's a very young country, not dissimilar to the U.S., but mm-hmm. it's 100 years younger than the U.S.
Yeah.
There is still this sort of siloed feeling that as much as it is a diverse country, I think that we identify first as our ethnicity and then as Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas here in the United States, and I've lived here now just as long as I lived in Canada, I think Americans identify first and foremost as American and then by whatever ethnicity they have or their heritage.
I think that's
right.
And I
feel it.
Yeah.
I feel a difference.
I feel like for some people since October 7th, for some Jewish Americans, then maybe that order is flipping.
Yes, perhaps it is.
You know, mm-hmm. But I certainly have observed the same as you just outlined.
I also notice that when I moved to New York, which obviously has a massive Jewish population, the majority of friends here or Jews that I meet here are very quick to tell me that they are, what's the term they use? Culturally Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
They make that distinction. They're always very quick to say, I'm culturally Jewish, meaning I was born Jewish and I eat a latke on Hanukkah. And that's all, that's fine. That's totally great. I'm not like judging that in any way. But interestingly, how I was raised, now coming to the States, I feel like I am one of the most religious people I know.
Yeah.
Not that I'm religious. And it's actually not about religion or even about spirituality, although I do think I'm possibly more spiritual than most of the Jewish Americans I know. But more culturally observant.
Right. More Jewish literacy.
More Jewish literacy.
Yeah. I have felt the same way at times where I'll be on like a Jewish program even. And, you know, I grew up being conservative like you. And a lot of my cousins and family are more modern Orthodox. And I was around a lot of Orthodox. So I never viewed myself as being at the top of the observancy chain. But then I'll get into a space here, even a Jewish one. I'm like, oh, I'm the only one that knows this prayer? That's interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
That is exactly the feeling I have.
Yeah. I'm assuming you guys celebrated Shabbat growing up.
Absolutely.
Do you still do that with your own family?
I do. We aren't as excellent about doing it every Friday night, but it is something that our children, especially if we're with any other family, if our mm-hmm. grandparents or our cousins are with us, we absolutely do. And we try to as much as we can. If anything, just light candles.
Yeah.
Say a prayer over wine and challah and have a moment.
Yeah.
There's nothing either of my children love more than like dipping their challah in their grape juice.
Challah in the grape
That's
juice?
That's their thing. They love it.
I was like, is she going to say soup? Is she going to say honey?
Also soup, sometimes salt. You know, my father-in-law insists that we dip it in a little salt.
I love a challah dip in the chicken soup.
Oh, it's yeah, like, of course.
The greatest.
They like to dip it in the grape juice.
The grape juice. All right. You know,
I don't know,
kids
it's a
these
thing.
Days.
Weird, but they like it. I kind of get it.
When you guys get together for holidays, who cooks?
Interestingly, my mom and I don't cook together so much.
Hmm.
I cook in my kitchen for her, and she cooks in her kitchen for me. I cook for my kids if I'm home in her kitchen, but it's her kitchen, and I sort of respect that. We don't cook so well together anymore, which is too bad, but also we respect each other.
Right. Well, you're both like
yes, we're territorial. My mother-in-law, when I spend holidays there, we cook together a lot. She's also a great cook, a really enthusiastic cook, and we cook together all the time. Maybe because there's lower stakes, you know, for whatever reason.
Yeah.
She's actually taught me a lot of Jewish recipes that I didn't know about beforehand, you know, just from her,
different
their
background.
Side of the family. Yeah, yeah. It opened up a whole new vocabulary of Jewish food for
That's
me.
That's cool.
But they're always my latkes. Hanukkah is absolutely my latkes all the time.
Are they your mom's recipe?
Yes, which are really my Aunt Sue's recipe.
Okay, we got to give props to Aunt Sue.
Yeah, she's the best.
Okay, awesome. What makes those latkes so fantastic?
Two things. One, I use a food processor to shred them, which is kind of controversial.
Is it? What else do people use?
A lot of people still believe that you can only use a box grater, like a cheese grater, to grate them. My problem with that is the strands are very short. And follow me here. Yep. If you're grating very short strands and packing them in together, they're packed a lot more tightly, which means they're a denser latke as opposed to longer strands that sort of give way to an airier, crunchier.
I'm looking for that crunch.
Latke. Some people are really against it. Like I get Jewish mamas telling me that if it's not done on a box grater, like they don't want to hear about it.
Relax.
Old school versus new school.
I guess.
The other thing is I put a lot of dill in my latkes, which also can be polarizing.
I think dill is never the wrong answer.
Agreed.
Yeah. This from the pickle aficionado.
Yes, exactly.
You're known for this famous family brisket recipe that belonged to your mom that you've zhuzhed up a little bit.
Yes.
I looked up this recipe. It looks absolutely ridiculous.
It's delicious.
But
it's delicious.
It looks really hard to make.
Here's the thing about brisket. It's sort of how you have to make it. Brisket is a cut that can't be quickly tenderized. You know, it's a tough cut of meat. It requires braising. And if you're going to do it properly, I don't know if there's a brisket recipe anywhere in the world that's going to take shorter than 3 hours to make if you're cooking for a crowd.
Okay, so you already talked about being at McGill. Mm-hmm. You're writing restaurant reviews. I don't know. It looks like your career is maybe going to be a food critic or something. And then you go to culinary school in the United States.
Yes.
Was that about trying to, I'm going to be a chef now? Or is it like I need to get, you know, grad school food experience to then become this writer?
You nailed it.
That was it.
Grad school food experience.
Right.
So I went to culinary school and moved to New York. I left the newspaper, did a year of culinary school. Okay. And then they convinced me to go cook as opposed to what I thought I was going to do, which was, oh, I've finished culinary school. Now I can go and get a job at Food & Wine magazine and work in their test kitchen. And maybe I could have. But I'm really glad that they convinced me to cook professionally because that was really where the learning happened, right?
Okay, so then you end up at Food & Wine magazine directing special projects.
Yes.
Including the Aspen Food & Wine Classic,
correct,
which as all Top Chef viewers know is part of the prize
it
package
is
for winning
That's
the
right.
show, along with the cover story in the magazine. So I'm sensing there had to be some kind of bridge between
there was
being at Food & Wine to you being on Top Chef.
It was about a year into my time at Food & Wine when Bravo came to Food & Wine, to our publisher and our associate publisher at the time, my bosses, and said, we have this crazy idea for a show. They had just launched Project Runway to much acclaim.
Yeah.
And they wanted to spin it off into the kind of the other pillars of what Bravo was doing at the time. And the first was food. But they admitted that they didn't know anything about food. They had never done a food show before.
Yeah, Bravo wasn't doing food. You said what
Not
they're
at
doing
all.
At the time. They weren't doing anything like this.
The only thing they had about food was Queer Eye. And they had Ted Allen,
right,
who was the food guy
right.
on the original Queer Eye.
Right.
And those five guys, the Fabulous Five, became the pillars by which for a while all of Bravo did its programming.
Interesting.
So for a while there was fashion, food, hair, design, and pop culture, right? Those were the five sort of categories of Bravo.
Yeah.
This was, you know, in the early aughts.
Mm-hmm.
And they came to Food and Wine to say, teach us about food. You know, give us a door to the world of chefs and food and helping us discover young talent. In exchange, if we like one of your editors, we'll put them on the judges panel to represent the magazine on the show. They sent me for a screen test. I had also never known what a screen test was.
Who's before. They? The people at
My
your
publisher,
magazine?
Yeah, Food & Wine magazine. They put me in a room with a camera on and asked me a whole bunch of questions. And about 3 weeks later, called my publisher and said, tell Gail we're flying to San Francisco to shoot the first season of this show.
Wow.
And it was absolutely bone-chillingly scary. You just have no idea how anything is going to turn out. And will it be gimmicky? More than anything, will our industry think that we were a joke? Because we wanted to make a serious show about the real life of young chefs, finding the next great kind of industry stars.
Mm-hmm.
But could we do that without it feeling cheesy or, you know, kitschy?
Right. Speaking of, Mazel Tov, this is your Chai year anniversary of the show.
That's right.
In Hebrew, all letters have number values. The word Chai means life, and the letters Chet and Yud equal 18. So that's why it's the Chai year anniversary. That's nuts.
It is nuts. It's amazing to think that like the majority of my adult life has been spent making this show.
Bravo's with their like one cooking show still that, you know, is before Below Deck Mediterranean.
Yes.
And here you guys
nothing
are
in common,
season
although we've
22.
Always really wanted to do a like Tom on Below Deck cooking.
Oh, I would watch that.
Mashup, I think it would be incredible. Our crew is always gunning for it. He will have nothing to do with it.
Sure.
We were lucky to be in the moment we were in pop culture, in the world of food.
Yeah.
There's two things about the format of the show that I think have been a reason for its success for sure. One is that we change location every season. It's not a studio show.
Right. Keeps
we're
it spicy.
We're on location. And every location informs the look and feel of the show so much.
Yeah.
And the challenges and the food we eat. And by the food we eat, it allows us to do such a deep dive into the culture, geography, history of a place.
Mm-hmm.
So the food becomes so much more than just the dishes that are put on the plates for us every week.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that it's always been about the chefs. They are the backbone. I mean, Tom and I and Kristen, Padma, obviously, for so many years, we were the mainstays. You knew that you were there. Like, we were there. But our show has always not been about us.
Something that I really admire about Top Chef is the way that you all have handled this, you know, cultural shift in America towards inclusivity.
Yes.
That's, you know, sort of been mandated by the culture. And you see a lot of things across entertainment, across all industries where they're sort of jamming it in there.
Yeah.
But when you guys do it, it's been so organic and smartly done. You know, you've brought in this deep bench of successful former contestants who are already there, who are already part of the Top Chef life, and they come in now and bring so much color and diversity and different styles.
Mm-hmm.
It's always like about the story and the food, and it all feels very organic and natural. And I've loved seeing that. I think there's nobody doing that better, honestly.
I appreciate that so much because we spend a lot of time talking about it. It's what makes the show so interesting because our casting team really has found and continues to find chefs that like are undeniably now leaders in our industry. If you look
totally.
At the track record of our chefs, and that's not our doing, right?
No, they're
we
just
give
great
them
chefs.
The platform, but they are genuinely extraordinary people.
Do you keep any mementos or souvenirs from your seasons?
Yes.
What do you keep?
This year, our set was outrageously beautiful and very Canadian, and you're going to have to kind of wait and see.
Okay.
But there was some incredible Indigenous art on the walls. And when they took down the set, they let me have a small piece.
Nice.
And it felt really, really meaningful. And I have it now hanging in my house. So that's very special.
Do you guys have a nickname for the show, like a shorthand? Or is it always when you're it's Top Chef?
Or chef.
Chef.
It's called Chef.
One of the most successful Jewish chefs to compete on the show is Sarah Bradley from Kentucky.
Yes.
Who incorporated a lot of Jewish inspiration into her dishes, which was really cool to see
as a
Jew at home. Was there any like connection between you two over that aspect of your...
She came back for All Stars.
Right. And that's where I remember her doing a lot of the Jewish stuff.
Absolutely. We do get to know them pretty well just from serving and judges table and you know the time we spend with them on camera. So I got a sense of who she was that way, and certainly from some of the food. And I think there was an understanding that I got what she was going for.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask it. When are we getting a Jewish food challenge? Like,
it's a good question.
You know, I have many ideas.
Yes.
We could, you know, Shabbat dinner challenge.
There's so many.
Where everybody makes a Shabbat dinner. And that we could do like a Rosh Hashanah quick fire, apples and honey.
It's
we
a good
could
pairing.
Do like learning from a Jewish Persian guest chef.
Yes. I
so,
like it. Keep
you know,
going.
If you're looking
you're
for a
job.
Jewish consulting
you're
producer,
doing an excellent
you know,
job producing.
Get some like a Shuk episode. They got to run through the Shuk
yes.
and gather things.
There's so many things I'd like to do.
Yeah.
The challenges start with the context of where we are, right? First and foremost.
Right.
And that sort of informs a lot of things.
Sure.
So that's why it's been hard to necessarily out of nowhere just have a Jewish challenge.
Mm.
But there is something this season that isn't quite Jewish, but that speaks to a lot of Jewish flavors and ingredients. And it was one of the best episodes, I think, from a creativity standpoint that our chefs have ever done.
Wow.
We were all in awe of them. So I'm really excited for the world to see that. I don't necessarily think that people will identify it as a Jewish challenge,
mm-hmm.
but it's undeniable that there are elements of Judaism in the ingredients we use.
Very mysterious.
I'm being elusive.
No, it's fine. I'm probably under some
exciting.
Sort of NDA,
yeah.
but I'm psyched. Now I'm even
it's
more
excited.
It's
pretty fun. It's pretty
That's great. Awesome. The crew, everybody, it's such a warm, longstanding, mm-hmm. familial environment. Since October 7th, mm-hmm. have you felt supported by this community? Has there been difficulties?
It's a great question.
Yeah.
It's been on my mind a lot, or it was on my mind a lot going into this season. It occurred to me that the last time we were all together was before October 7th. We
right.
wrapped season 21 in Wisconsin. I think we were sort of home before October 1st. And then we met up for a week of the finale in early November, but so much was yet to unfold.
Right.
And coming back for the season, it occurred to me, and I had never qualified it this way, that there aren't actually a lot of other Jews on my set. Of this 150-person amazing group, there are a few.
Sure.
But I guess I had taken it for granted and never thought about it before.
Yeah.
And I had fears. But overall, I have felt enormously supported. There are certainly people with different views than me on the set.
Mm-hmm.
Our production company, Magical Elves, is very serious about setting up a conversation in advance about what is appropriately brought to work every day. And just from an HR perspective, making sure that we are an inclusive, kind, positive environment to work in for
mm-hmm.
everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really important to me.
Yeah.
The people that I work with the most, especially Tom and Kristen, have never shown anything but support and love and appreciation for me in a time of need. They have been by my side from the start and very vocal, and also just, you know, as true friends, been there for whatever I need and have honored that, which I've been really grateful for.
That's so great to hear.
And same really with the people who I'm, you know, working the closest with day to day, my makeup artist and our head of wardrobe and her team and the producers that I work with on the kind of senior producers that I'm working with and talking to many times a day, our director and the AD team. So I never felt even an ounce when I was there like we weren't all there for the right reasons and that
That's
we didn't
amazing.
Make each other. Like we never made any, no one ever made me uncomfortable being on set at all.
That's so great to hear.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really glad
yeah.
to hear that.
But it was definitely top of mind.
Yeah, as it has been for everybody.
Yes.
Did discussions about the conflict and current events come up, you know, in the downtime?
Only in downtime. Absolutely.
In like a shoot the shit kind of a way?
In a shoot the shit kind okay. of way. Or sometimes more serious. You know,
yeah.
Tom isn't really a shoot the shitter.
Mm-hmm. I can get that vibe.
Yeah, I mean, he's a great conversationalist.
Sure,
but
sure.
His conversations are serious. And he is an incredible activist, an incredible advocate in general for a lot of things. You know, and I think he's also been really vocal and supportive of the Jewish predicament in America right now. He's married to a Jewish woman whose mother is a Holocaust, her parents were Holocaust
wow.
survivors. Most of her family live in Israel. He's raising his children Jewish. I was at his son's bar mitzvah last
year. Oh my gosh.
So he is, you know, deeply, deeply aware of the issues, and his ability to articulate it is actually remarkable. And he's been incredibly helpful and supportive.
That's so fantastic.
Yeah.
That's got to feel so good.
It does. You just need an ally.
Yeah, the allies feel the best. Mm-hmm. It really does. You've been vocal and visible in your support for the Jewish community on social media and through your cooking on TV. Mm-hmm. And so shortly after October 7th, you posted the following. I am a proud Jew. We account for only 0.2% of the world population, and I feel compelled to use my voice. I'm tired of buts and whatabouts anytime I see anything positive about Israel. I'm begging you to acknowledge our pain, grief, and fear without qualification. I'm asking you to stand up against anti-Semitism. I am daring you to celebrate our humanity. Beautiful statement.
Thank you.
How was it received?
Very positively.
Good.
When I wrote that, it took me a long time.
Clearly, a lot of thought went into that.
More time than, I mean, I was petrified, truthfully, to post anything.
Yeah.
I didn't ever feel like that was my, I never felt that there would be a time. I could never have imagined a time where I had need to have said those words so clearly and that it could ever be met with anything otherwise, right? This has all
right.
been so unfathomable. I definitely had some help in finishing it by
our mutual friend,
Chen, who is an extraordinary advocate and helped me really to get it through the cross the finish line because I was so afraid.
Wow.
Largely, it was met with positivity and support. I've never had something sort of, I guess, go viral in that way. I've never had anything that so many people came out of the woodwork to talk about mm-hmm. to me or reach out to me about on both sides of the argument.
Uh-huh.
And yes, certainly I understood that by saying it, I would polarize a lot of people. And there's always going to be people, obviously, who dissent. There's always going to be people who tell me to just stick to food. That is something people love to say,
sure.
right? It happens to everyone.
Yeah.
Because we are one-dimensional, right? We can't cook and also have feelings
right.
or also identify.
You're only the
culturally.
Thing I watch you on TV for.
That's right.
I mean, that's everybody in
yes.
every industry who
Correct.
Dares to say anything outside of the very narrow lane for which we know them.
That's right. And so it was really, it really felt like new territory to me. And my husband, actually, the original idea for the post
mm-hmm.
was my husband writing it. He couldn't sleep. None of us could sleep. But he
yeah.
woke up one night and wrote it down, sort of a first draft.
Yeah, yeah.
And gave it to me, and I sort of started working on it and posting it. And he has been incredibly encouraging too, because this is something very personal for him, as it is for us all, for
yeah.
all those same reasons. And so I was really grateful that I did it, like happy and relieved. And as many bridges as it might have burned, I definitely saw my followers go down in that period somewhat
mm-hmm.
More over the, you know, the months that followed. Certainly I definitely saw a lot of vicious hate in certain ways, but I think that like anything that you say publicly, those are the loudest voices, but they are not the majority of the voices. And I think by and large the positivity that came of it, the connections I made, the community that reached out to me like you
yeah.
and so many others, not known friends from years ago that I hadn't spoken to, people I never knew, strangers on the street. I think that far surpassed any fear of anything else that I was worried about. And it ultimately put more into focus my voice and who I am as a person. And I can't pretend to be anything else.
Can you articulate what it was you were afraid of?
My, you know, fear of, I guess, just hate, vicious venomness, hate speech. Also, I feel as a public person very vulnerable, right?
Yeah.
Exposed. Mm-hmm. I have a family. I have young children
yeah.
who are only at the sort of very edges of understanding any of this.
Mm-hmm.
My son is six. He
yeah.
lives in a very beautiful world that I want to protect him in
yes,
forever.
Thank God for that.
Yes. My daughter hears and knows everything, but it is very confusing. And it's just, there's so many mixed messages out there. There's so much untruth. There's so much confusion on the subject. And I want her to feel comfortable about who she is too.
Yeah.
And then you worry about real acts of hate.
Yeah.
And it used to feel like something that was so at arm's length from our lives. But not long ago, I woke up one morning to find a big news story that there had been a swastika painted on the jungle gym in the park. And that is 6 blocks from my house.
Yeah.
Not even. And that was the first time really it felt like it was infiltrating my universe in a very real physical way.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately we were not harmed, but it just, it made me realize like we can't, we, as much as we live in a world where I can feel like none of this touches me, it absolutely does. And certainly after October 7th, I realized just how deeply it touches me and how deeply it affects so many people I know, both here and of course in Israel.
Have there been other times you've wanted to say more or post something else, but you have decided not to?
Sure. Since then, certainly.
Yeah.
I feel like I should be doing more all the time, more. And I'm often overwhelmed by it.
Sure.
And my issue is always, am I contributing noise or not, right? Like, what am I saying that isn't already being said? Or how much power do I really have? And how much do I want to alienate other people? Or right. Is it alienating? I mean, I know you know this because you've been so excellent at articulating your feelings on the subject and trying to sort of sift through that noise. But I do find there are many days where all I want to do is just hug my children and turn off social media, right?
Totally.
Because that's where most of it lives. And I kind of yeah. hate that too.
Yeah. It's sort of not real in a way.
That's right.
Just all,
so
if you don't look at your phone.
How can we be effective and say things that mean something that aren't just living on my phone?
Right. I will say, and you know, it's this sort of came up on my first episode with Skylar Astin, mm-hmm. who sort of said the same thing. Mm-hmm. He did a big post in October, then never really posted about it again for some of the same reasons. And what I said to him, I'll say to you, which is you being who you are and saying things, no matter what it is empowering for people.
Yeah.
And makes people feel less alone and makes people feel seen. And so, you know, I would encourage you, if there's something on your mind and you feel like maybe I should say this, that, you know, it is going to help.
Yeah.
Like,
you're right.
Guaranteed it's going to help somebody.
You're right. The amount of times that I hesitate because I feel like there is so much out there and I get lost in it. I really do.
Yeah. You've been to Israel several times. Mm-hmm. In 2019, you went on a free trip with a bunch of other Jewish food luminaries.
They weren't even all Jewish. I would say only about 50% of our trip was Jewish, which made it even better.
That's even better. How incredible was that trip? And like, how do I get on the next one yeah. with that crew?
I will get you there.
Thank you.
2019, I was approached by a close friend in the industry who organized what he came to call like chef birthright, essentially.
Right.
Although it wasn't birthright because a lot of people weren't Jewish necessarily. But it was a chef trip to Israel to learn about agriculture and the food and restaurant scene and to really do like a very intense dive into the food and people of Israel, the history. And that did not mean necessarily Jewish by any means.
Sure.
The food has always been nuanced and extraordinary because it's just at this crossroads of a million things, yeah. right? A million influences. To see it as a professional and to see it alongside so many great chefs that I admired and have this moment of discovery with them was so special. And we did so many things. I mean, we cooked with chefs. We cooked in people's homes. We went to the biggest children's hospital and did cooking demos for the children. We went to like, you know, food labs and innovation hubs. We went to farms. We ate some of the most beautiful special meals of my lifetime.
Wow, you really packed it in.
It just was amazing. Like countless memories.
Also, I read you volunteered at a kibbutz.
I did.
Where, when, how?
I had been to Israel when I was 16 with my family and a bunch of other families for my cousin's bar mitzvah. And that was sort of the 2-week bus tour, hit every major site, go from morning till dawn.
Right.
And we did everything. I mean, you can do a lot in 2 weeks in Israel. It's
oh,
a small
yeah.
country, right? And then 2 summers later, I decided with my boyfriend at the time, my high school boyfriend, that we would go and spend the summer there. I was 18. There were no cell phones. I went to the Middle East for 2 months with a boyfriend that honestly, my parents weren't sure was the right one for me. And it turned out they were correct. You know, things don't work out. We were 18 years old.
Sure.
Right? I was working on an unknown kibbutz near the Lebanese border in a town called Naharia, a kibbutz called Beit HaEmek. And it was a beautiful, amazing place fraught with problems as the sort of system of kibbutz can be.
Mm.
you know, started as a movement to farm the land during independence.
Right.
And in really socialist ideal of community that is extraordinary in theory, but harder in practice as the world changes around it.
Yeah.
My first job on the kibbutz was working in the chicken farm, in the lull, in the chicken coop. And I worked there picking eggs. We weren't killing chickens, although we had to kill the occasional chicken when a chicken was sick.
Got to kill a sick chicken, yeah.
It's a quick just snap of the...
Did you do it yourself?
Once in a while. Okay. I was taught to do it.
Nice.
Which was a huge lesson for an 18-year-old girl.
Yeah.
So we picked eggs 5 times a day from 5:30 in the morning until sort of 2 in the afternoon, and then it got too hot. And then they moved me to the kitchen.
Hey.
To like the mess hall, you know, where we were serving food for the entire kibbutz, about 600 people 3 times a day.
Whoa.
And that was my first professional kitchen.
That's cool.
And I learned so much in that kitchen. I mean, you start as a dishwasher, and I washed dishes 6-8 hours a day.
Whoa.
For a few weeks. I just had my Sony Walkman that I'd gotten for my bat mitzvah. Like, yeah. Strapped on, clipped onto my pants.
Was it yellow?
It was yellow.
Yes.
Of course it was yellow. Why were they yellow?
They stand out.
Yes, they really did. And that was a huge lesson in patience and understanding of my ability, sort of mind over matter. And then they moved me to the breakfast kitchen, and I learned to cook eggs. And I cooked eggs every morning from 4 in the morning because breakfast started at 6:30. And I was making hundreds and hundreds of eggs a day.
What's the trick for making 500 eggs?
Well, we had to cook them in different ways, right? So there's a scramble where you're breaking and making a scramble mix of dozens of eggs at a time, and you're working on a flat top.
Right.
So you have this sort of huge scraper spatula instrument that moves it around. I also made fried eggs, and I would just kind of crack rows of eggs. And by the time you get to the end of that row, you go back to the top and flip, and it's ready. Huh. So you have a huge long spatula. It was great work. Wow. I mean, easy to say now. I remember at the time it was sort of torturous.
Sure.
But it was the understanding of how a real kitchen worked.
When it comes to contemporary Jewish food, mm-hmm. what would you like to see next? Like, where can we expand? What can we do that we haven't done yet?
Well, I think there's a lot that's happening, actually. And there's a lot of chefs I love seeing who are doing a lot of really interesting Jewish food, bringing back ingredients that were largely taken for granted,
like,
and
what?
Exalting them. Cabbage. Things, you know, that all of a sudden, you know, a lot of the food that I associate with Jewish food, like a lot of immigrant cultures, are food that is cheap, that could stretch. Things like the brisket, right? Things mm-hmm. like the matzah ball. I mean, matzah meal was a very humble ingredient. Things like the beet and the cabbage. And I feel like that's just one, obviously, little corner of the Jewish universe.
Sure,
but I
sure.
love how you recenter them, and there are so many great chefs doing beautiful things with them, with vegetables that are not just cooked within an inch of their life anymore, but that are shown respect. And also the nuance of Israeli food and the influences from all over the world that Israeli food encompasses. You don't want to say improving on them, because in a lot of ways they were perfect, but I think that
expanding
them. And I also am really obsessed with the world of deli.
Uh-huh.
Jewish deli is not the same everywhere, but I love the study of deli all over the world and how Eastern European Jews took their ways of preserving food to wherever they landed, whether that was New York or LA or Montreal or Argentina. And you find these very similar things that just have evolved to make sense in the place they land.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think a lot of immigrants tell the story that they move to another country and they want to make the food from their home country, but right. they have to adapt it to the ingredients they have. Sort of two things happen, and this is certainly true for Jewish deli. You adapt it to the ingredients that you have, but you also then put your technique onto local ingredients, which changes sort of both sides of the dish itself, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Jewish deli is like such an amazing focused study of that.
Now I'm getting hungry.
Yeah.
So we got to wrap this up. Thanksgiving's coming up pretty soon. Mm-hmm. What's going to be on your menu?
Good question. I feel like I'm an outlier. I didn't grow up with Thanksgiving, right? Because
Canada
Thanksgiving is not celebrated the way it is here.
Sure.
It is by far my favorite adopted holiday.
Really?
Well, it is universal. It's in America, it's non-denominational.
Right.
And it's really an excuse to cook. It is the day that you just focus on the food.
Yeah,
everybody,
big time.
No matter who you are, what you do. And it's so traditional. And I love that everyone adapts it to who they are and where they're from.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm an outlier in that I love turkey. So many people tell me they hate the turkey. It's all about the sides. Yeah. I get it. Turkey can be bland, but I love the ritual of making turkey. I love the basting of the turkey. I love the piling on of the things with the turkey.
What do you mean?
I love the cranberry sauce, and I love the gravy, and I love the mashed potatoes. And better yet, I love the gravy and the cranberry sauce and the mashed potatoes on top of the turkey. Mm, mm-hmm. So I just feel like it's just soul food.
My controversial hot take is I hate Thanksgiving dinner.
Why?
I don't like any of those foods.
Really?
I mean, I like turkey, but it's
right, you're like, it's fine.
It's fine. Mashed potatoes, they're fine. Mm. Cranberry, I'm out on.
Okay. All right.
You know, it's heavy.
It is.
Like, you know, I like fresh and light and flavorful.
But you can do those things, right? Like, I say, switch it up, Jonah.
I'd like to. I don't host it. I've never hosted it. You know, it'll be my mom's house. Right. And
it's hard to change tradition.
Yeah.
I get it.
It's fine. I'll be all right.
I get it. I know you will be. But I say maybe you bring one thing that changes a little bit.
Well, I bring the wine.
Okay, so, the wine's important. You know,
I'll make us have a good time.
Yes. Okay. I'll take it.
Okay, the most important question of this entire episode, how do I get to eat at Restaurant Wars?
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
You know, you've got a direct line.
Yes.
So season 23, we can discuss.
Okay.
The trickiest thing, and people ask that all the time.
Of course. I'm like, who are these
set?
Lucky people
yes.
who are
they
at
are
this chili dog
family.
Fair?
Yes, they are friends and family.
In Wisconsin, we know 200 friends and family.
I don't. I did know,
but like
weirdly,
people,
a few people. But it's friends and family of a lot of people, right? We have a big crew, and then there's always the tourism board of wherever we are.
And they're helping you get people.
Yeah, exactly. But you will notice in season 22's Restaurant Wars that an inordinate amount of my high school girlfriends are sitting behind me.
Okay, amazing.
So just look out for them because they're awesome.
I will. I'm going to keep an eye out. Everybody,
you heard it here.
My dad's
in an episode.
Oh, that's so fun. That's great.
It was great.
Okay, to end my questions, and then we'll go to some audience questions mm-hmm. on something a little more serious.
Sure.
What would your message be today about standing up and celebrating the Jewish people and being Jewish?
That's a big question, Jonah.
I know. That's why I saved it for last.
Yes, yes. I will preface by saying that there are so many things I did not appreciate about being Jewish until recently.
Mm-hmm.
And I am unable to deny pieces of who I am. The majority of us want the same thing.
Yep.
Which is to live safely and peacefully with people that we love and to be able to show that love. And I will say that is a tenet of Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
And that the other tenet I think about more than ever, tikkun olam, to heal the world, is always at the foremost of my mind, at the front of my mind, when I think about what I can do in my everyday life right now. And that often just means little things, patience and kindness, because you never know where anyone else is coming from. And you hope that people will do you the same grace. So I would say celebrating who you are and your community has never been more important, because it is what makes us human. It is what makes us civilized. It is what makes us able to live peacefully and safely. And that's
beautiful.
All you can do.
That was great. Okay, couple quick questions from social media.
Okay.
The Mrs. Barham says, they say food has healing powers. What's your go-to healing food for yourself?
Hmm. I mean, maybe it's cliche, but matzo ball soup.
I mean, it's just so good.
It is the penicillin of the world.
It is so nourishing. It really is.
It's nourishing. I served it for my daughter and husband last night because they were both feeling under the weather.
A lot of dill?
A lot of dill.
It's key.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
MP7072 asks, what was your favorite camp food at Camp New Moon? Because they also went to Camp New Moon.
Camp New Moon's a Jewish camp. I went from age 10 to age 14. And then I moved to a different summer camp, all in Canada, all outside Toronto. There's a very vibrant Jewish summer camp situation. It's fantastic, actually. And it is by far, like, my strongest memories of growing up in the community I grew up in was those incredible summers spent at summer camp.
Well.
Favorite food, I mean, I remember tuck, which was at two or three times a week we got candy. And
what'd you call it, tuck?
Tuck.
What does that refer to?
The tuck shop was the store at camp. Most of the week, it was just for buying supplies that you needed. You need new batteries for your flashlight. Mm-hmm. You need mosquito repellent, things like that.
For any Gen Zers listening, a flashlight is a device that you put something called batteries in, and it provides light if your cell phone is not around you.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
Yep.
So But two or three times a week, the tuck shop would give us, after lunch, during rest hour, we got tuck. We got a choice of candy.
We had the same thing. We called it canteen.
Okay, canteen. So yeah. Very similar.
Okay. Tuck. It was just
I don't know why we call it tuck, but it's not just that wasn't a Newman word. That is like a Canadian Jewish, or just a Canadian summer camp word.
Hmm.
I always got Twizzlers, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, or something called Hickory Sticks, which they don't have in the United States. They're like a potato chip, but they're shredded potato chips, and they have like a hickory barbecue flavor. Ooh. And they're delicious.
That sounds good. I was like a Rolos and soda guy.
Yeah, Rolos was solid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, last, from some lady named Courtney Ann Platt. not a question, but please know our son Joey used to play pretend Top Chef in his little outdoor kitchen and make us the judges. Top Chef is a family affair in our house.
Thank you, Courtney. That means a lot. I will say the biggest unexpected surprise about Top Chef when we set out to make it was never, like, we did not expect it to be a family show as much as it is. Not that we were trying to make some sort of racy show. No. And I think the earlier years were a little bit sort of more dramatic, a little dirtier, a little, you know, worse language, things like that. But the best outcome that we didn't expect was that so many kids watch our show. And it has become like a family tradition in so many households. And that is huge for all of us.
Gail, please pack your knives and go.
Yeah.
I had to do it. I'm sorry. Does everyone do that every time
you're interviewed? No, I like it, actually. No one's ever said it directly to me. And
it felt
kind of good.
Yes. thank you so much for being here. It's really been terrific having you.
Thank you, Jonah. Really appreciate it.
A million thank yous to my guest, Gail Simmons, for joining me today. I won't hold it against her that she didn't bring any snacks. Thanks to the folks here at Hoff Studios for having us. Thanks to the Odeon for a great lunch earlier. And thanks to all of you for listening and watching. Please, if you like the show, tell your communities about it. Throw it on the Temple e-blast next to the Men's Club lunch above the Request for More Ushers. And be sure to subscribe to the podcast and our YouTube. Follow us on all the socials. Leave us 5-star reviews on Apple and Spotify. I'll see y'all back here for the next energizing episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt.
Thank you to everyone who makes Being Jewish with Jonah Platt possible. Executive producer Matthew Jones, story producer Sean Leviashvili, and editor Patrick Edwards of Rainbow Creative. Consulting producers Bethany Mandel and Ariella Novak of Shield Communications. Social media manager Yuval Yosha. Graphic designer Noah Bell of Bellboy Creative. My incredible research assistant, Samantha Greenwald, everyone at Aura House Studios, the whole team at Jewish Broadcasting Service, composer Gabe Mann, and of course you, dear listeners, who even stuck around to listen to all these credits. Man, I love you guys.